The DA is a looker. Pretty, blonde, blue-eyed, and a killer. Very ambitious. Dennis would like some of that. Chad Meldrin stands up. Very interesting that Chad showed up, Dennis thinks. Either Dwayne's bosses are backing him up big time, or they want him out of lockup where they can kill him. Your Honor, Chad says, smiling like he's about to say that night tends to be darker than day. Mr. Crow has no prior drug arrests, never mind convictions. He has ties to the community and he owns a business. You and I both know that this case doesn't even belong in federal court. This is the government throwing its weight around, and in fact, I'm preparing a motion to have the case removed to the jurisdiction of the state of California, where it belongs. As we both know, that motion has an excellent chance of success. I'm going to request that you do grant bail and set it at a reasonable amount so that my client can continue to make a living and also fully participate in his own defense. And he's going to do that from where, Costa Rica? Ryan snaps.
That will be enough of that, Judge Giannini says.
He's a flight risk, Your Honor, Ryan repeats. And may I remind the court that these charges include possession of a firearm while in the commission of a drug felony. Mr. Crow is a danger to the public. The gun was not in Mr. Crow's possession, Chad argues. It was found in the vicinity of Mr. Crow's vehicle. And had Mr. Hennessy's fingerprints on it? Mr. Hennessy is not Mr. Crow, Meldrin says. Ryan says, May I also remind the court?
The court does not have Alzheimer's, Giannini snaps. She's in a pissy mood, Dennis thinks.
Good. Ryan keeps pressing. This is not only a marijuana charge. Heroin, a Schedule II narcotic, is involved, and in the vicinity of a school.
At 1 in the morning, Chad says, throwing his arms in the air. No jury is going to believe that Mr. Crow is attempting to sell to schoolchildren.
The law does not specify intent, Ryan answers. Proximity is sufficient.
Chad turns and looks directly at Dennis.
We have seen these shenanigans from Agent Kane before. This is an old dog doing old tricks. It's an outrageous abuse of authority.
Dennis smiles at him.
Your Honor, Ryan says, Agent Kane is not on trial here.
He should be, Chad snaps. This whole case is a setup from Jump Street, Your Honor, and I will argue entrapment. The government has used a so far unidentified CI to lure an otherwise innocent...
We'll produce the witness at trial, Ryan says.
Giannini says, Let's get back to the point here. I tend to agree that the weapons allegation will probably not survive judicial scrutiny as to Mr. Crow. I also tend to agree that while the severity of possible penalties is an inducement toward flight, Mr. Crow's standing in the community and the fact that he owns a business are mitigating factors. Therefore, I'm inclined to grant bail.
Would the government like to suggest a figure, Ms. Ryan?
$10 million.
Look at my face, Giannini says. Do I look like I'm in the mood for jokes, Ms. Ryan?
May I suggest O.R.? Chad asks.
Same answer, Chad, but nice try, Giannini says. I'm certainly not inclined to release Mr. Crow on his own recognizance. But I do see a need for a serious deterrent toward flight.
You want to come down on your bid, Ms. Ryan?
$1 million.
Bail is set at $500,000, Giannini says, with Mr. Crow's residence and business as security. Can you post the 10% today, Mr. Crow?
He can, Your Honor, Chad says.
I'll bet he can, Dennis thinks. The boys want him out, no question. Question is, who are the boys?
222.
You cut them loose?
Ben asks. They're sitting in Dennis's car in the parking lot of Albertsons in Laguna.
We can't hold them on the murder, Dennis explains. Unless one flips on the other, we have nothing.
I'll go in, Ben says. If that's the problem, I'll...
It won't do any good, Dennis says.
You can't put them on the scene, and they both have alibis.
If I go in and swear out a complaint against Crow for extortion...
The most you have on him is making a threat, Dennis answers. You can't even tie him to the beating Boland gave you. Never mind the murders.
So now what?
Run.
What?
Run, Ben.
Because these guys are out, and they're going to kill you.
223. Because, as Chan points out, the justice system is more about the system than the justice. Maybe Crow and Hennessy jump bail. Maybe they roll the dice with a trial on the drug charges. Maybe they take a chance on each other's holding firm. But the point is, they have problems of their own now. And so do the higher-ups. Someone paid a lot of money to spring Crow and Hennessy for fear they might flip in the interview room. But Dwayne and Brian still have good reason, double-digit prison sentences, to trade up. So the question is,
did they get them out to get them out? Chan asks Ben. Or to get them out of the way?
The latter of which leaves two options. Crow and Hennessy jump bail and disappear, or someone disappears them. In either case, the plan worked. Drop Crow into the shit and see who throws a line. But how do we track the line back? One of Ben and Chan's favorite movies is All the President's Men. They can practically quote it. Well, not practically. Actually. Driving back from Ben's meet with Dennis, they go into the routine.
Hunt's come in from the cold. Supposedly he's got a lawyer with $25,000 in a brown paper bag.
The prices have gone up, Bob.
Follow the money.
Follow the lawyer who brought the money, Ben says. Somebody sent Chad to bail Crow out. He's going to report back to that somebody, and he isn't going to do it over the phone.
Can you do it, bro?
Chan asks.
Follow him without getting seen?
Without getting killed?
I think so, Ben says.
I'll take the other line.
Crow and Hennessy have to be freaking. They know they're on thin ice. They're going to reach out. And up. It's a good situation, Chan thinks. If Crow and Hennessy had flipped on each other, Ben would have gotten his justice, but it would still have left the higher-ups out there, and they would have him killed. Better this way.
Ben?
Yeah.
Keep your head down.
You too.
Always.
Recent evidence to the contrary notwithstanding. 224. Dwayne Crow goes home long enough to pack a few things, because this could go either way. He folds his old guy's rule shirt into the duffel bag and thinks about the phone conversation that was less than reassuring. Yeah, we have judges, but this is federal, Dwayne. That makes it tough. Say you get 12, you serve 12. You can do 12, I've done it. You're still a young man when you get out. I'm not a young man now, Dwayne thinks. He grabs a couple of pairs of jeans out of a dresser drawer and throws them in the bag. I have a daughter going to college. I have tuition to pay. I can't do 1 year, never mind the cost of the trial, the defense. And that's just the drug charge. The other thing is a problem. If the other guy gets weak in the knees, you fucked up. You know, with the girl, it's a problem. Yeah, thanks a fucking heap. Tell me something I don't know. Just like the powers that be, you work your ass off for them, make them money, and then when there's a problem, they leave you on an island. But Dwayne gets the message. The powers that be will take a chance on the drug charge, but the homicides? If I don't do something about Brian, they're going to do something about me. They're going to clean house. Brian, Leonard, me. If they're not on their way already. He puts the revolver in his pocket and heads out. 225. Ben sits in his car and calls Chad Meldrin. The bored, too-cool-for-school receptionist puts him on hold. Comes back on a few seconds later and says, Chad said to say he can't represent you anymore.
Did he say why not?
Conflicted.
You or him?
She hangs up. But Ben knows what he wanted to know. Chad is in the office. Which works out because Ben is in the parking structure. All the President's Men. 226. O is conflicted as to what to wear.
She walks into her closet, surveys the hangers full of clothes, and tries to decide how to go, sartorially speaking. I mean, what does the style-conscious South Orange County princess wear to meet her father for the first time? Dress it up or cash it down? Go older or younger? She thinks about a polka-dot dress and pigtails, but decides it's way too creepy because maybe Paul Patterson doesn't have a sense of satire or irony. She looks at your basic little black dress, like, look at what a lovely lady the daughter you threw away turned out to be, but worries about crossing the paper-thin line between sophisticated and sexy. She thinks about not going at all. This is a girl who has stood in front of a vending machine, torn between F3, peanut M&Ms, and D7, Famous Amos chocolate chip cookies, for 15 minutes, and then walked away with nothing rather than make a choice. Oh, knows she doesn't have that luxury here. She has to wear something. She can't just go naked as the day she was born, as symbolically appropriate as that might be. You might be able to walk naked in Laguna without raising alarm or an eyebrow, but Newport Beach? They don't get undressed to have sex. You could get arrested in Newport for wearing white after Labor Day. Okay, this is getting you nowhere, O thinks. But maybe that's just where you should go. Maybe you should lie down, fire up a blunt, and forget it. 2:27. Chan pulls over near Crow's place up Laguna Canyon and looks at the driveway. Crow's car isn't there. Chan gets out, slips his pistol into his waistband, and goes to the front door. It's locked. The man has taken off. Chan doesn't blame him, but it's a problem. Not a big problem, but a problem. 2:28. Chad, no worries, Meldrin, comes into the parking structure like he has a problem. Worries. Has that places to go, people to see look on his face as he strides to his Benz, gets in, and peels out. Ben follows him, west on Jamboree, north on the PCH, all the way to the Newport Beach Yacht Club. Which figures, Ben thinks. Money is a pigeon. It always finds its way home. 2:29. This is like Republican Central. The party could hold its California convention right here, and Ben feels like he should have a visa to even get in. A 20 slipped into the doorman's palm.
Are you a member, sir?
No, but he is. Is sufficient documentation. But Ben feels out of place and a little hostile as he makes his way through the lobby and watches Meldrin go out onto the patio, overlooking the harbor, overlooking the yachts, where on this late Friday afternoon the elite are there to have a drink and to see and be seen. Ben's working hard at being Joe Detective, trying to blend into the crowd and still keep an eye on Meldrin without being seen, when he hears, Ben? 2:30. It's a woman's voice. Ben? Ophelia's friend? Is that you? Ben panics momentarily because, A, he doesn't want to lose sight of Chad, and, B, he can't think of her actual name. Only Paku. Oh, hi, Mrs. He damn near says four. It's Bennett now, she says, in a tone that manages to combine self-deprecating charm with a warning not to push the subject. Indeed, she's here cruising for his replacement. Four is about to become former. Mrs. Bennett. She's statuesque, sexy, beautiful, with all the genuine human warmth of an ice sculpture. Except, Ben remembers, O swears that she will not melt. O has watched The Wizard of Oz like 12,000 times to get tips. What brings you here? Paku looks a little surprised, as if she either can't understand why a friend of her daughter's would be at the club, or forgot that they let Jews in now. Ben catches sight of Chad's back. Oh, you know, Friday, the patio. Paku glances at his left hand. Yes, it can be quite the place to meet eligible young ladies.
Subtext, you'd better not be doing my daughter.
Is O with you? Ben asks, aware that if she is, she's in handcuffs and leg irons because O would rather sip cat urine straight from the cat than iced tea with her mother on the patio. Paku lets the O reference slide. No, I believe she's out seeking employment.
And I believe, Ben thinks, that Bin Laden is hitting open mic night at the West Akron Holiday Inn. He watches Meldrin go up to someone, then can't make out his face along the railing bar.
What do you do? Paku asks.
Sorry?
What do you do, Ben? Paku asks. For a living.
I'm an environmental consultant, Ben says,
still unable to get a good look at who Chad is talking to.
What does that mean?
It means I have to tell the IRS something, Ben thinks.
When a big building or a complex is going up, I advise the landscape architects what kind of trees, plants, and grasses to put in.
That sounds fascinating, Paku says. Very green, is that the word?
That's one of them.
What's another? She asks.
That's when Ben realizes she's a little drunk.
Bullshit,
Ben tells her.
It's all bullshit, Mrs. B.
She looks him straight in the eyes.
Ain't that the goddamn truth, Ben?
Yeah, it is. Because some people move out of the way, and Ben sees who Meldrin is talking to. Stan. 2:31. O, wearing a blue knee-length dress, walks up to the distinguished older home on Balboa Island and rings the bell. When the man comes to the door, she says,
Hi, would you be my sperm donor?
The man blinks and says,
Could I just take 3 boxes of Thin Mints, please?
2:32. Brian Hennessy opens the door of his apartment to a nasty surprise. Chon, who lays a shotgun stock into the base of Brian's skull. 2:33. Places Ben would expect to see his father before he would expect to see him on the patio. 1. A Republican National Committee fundraiser. 2. Dollywood. 3. Wines Are Us. 4. A monster truck show. 5. Rush Limbaugh's Small Intestine. 6. Anywhere. Ben fucking reels, turns and walks away. The truth always comes home, but not to his home. 2:34. When Brian comes to, he's duct taped to a chair. Chon sits across from him.
What did I tell you? Chon says. What did I tell you I'd do if you laid another hand on one of our people?
Brian remembers the answer.
Don't, please.
Say it. What did I tell you?
That you'd kill me.
Did you think I was kidding?
No.
Do you think I'm kidding now?
No, please, Jesus.
I'm going to give you one motherfucking chance, Chon says. One. To tell me the truth. If you lie, I'll know it, and I'll kill you. Tell me you understand, Brian.
I understand.
His legs are shaking.
Who pulled the trigger on Scott Munson and that girl?
Dwayne.
Dwayne Crow.
Brian nods.
What did you tell the cops?
Nothing.
Here's what you're gonna do, Chon says. You're going to call Crow, tell him you want to meet.
He won't come.
Tell him he comes or you tell the feds everything, Chon says. What's his number?
Brian tells him. Chon takes Brian's phone, punches in Crow's number, and holds it up to Brian's mouth. 2:35.
I meant sperm donor, not as in, would you give me some sperm, please, O says, but would you be the man who made a sperm deposit with or rather, within my mother that resulted in, well, me.
Paul Patterson recovers his poise quickly and says, "Come in, please." He ushers O into a beautifully furnished living room that looks, well, old. Old Newport Beach money. Photos of sailboats on the wall, wooden models of boats in glass cases.
"Do you sail?"
O asks.
"I used to," Patterson says. "Before I got, well, before I got too old."
He is older than he was in her fantasy. In her fantasy, he was in his late 40s, maybe, handsome, of course, with just a streak of silver in the temples of his otherwise jet-black hair. In her fantasy, he was athletic. He'd kept himself in shape. Maybe he was a tennis player, or a surfer, or an Ironman triathlete. The real man is in his early 60s. His hair is wispy, a weird kind of yellow and white. And he looks frail. His skin is translucent, like thin paper. Her father is dying.
"Please, sit down,"
he says, pointing to an upholstered wing-backed chair. She sits and feels uncomfortable. Small.
"Would you like something to drink?" he asks. "Iced tea or some lemonade?"
O loses it. Totally blows. All that pent-up emotional lava just freaking explodes. 2:36. Interior Paul Patterson's house, day. Oh.
Iced tea? Lemonade? That's it? After 19 fucking years, that's it? No hug, no kiss, no "it's so wonderful to finally meet you, I'm so sorry I abandoned you before you were born and broke your heart and totally fucked up your life"?
Patterson looks sad, even sadder as he answers, "Patterson,
my dear Ophelia."
2:37. Patterson goes counter Darth Vader on it.
"I am not your father."
2:38. Ben pulls into the driveway of his parents' house in the canyon. Gets out of the car, walks up to the door, takes a deep breath, and rings the bell. What the fuck do they have to do with all this? Ben wonders. For all their goofy, reconstructed hippie bullshit, they're essentially kind-loving people, caring therapists, good if overbearing parents. It feels like it takes forever, but his mother finally answers the door. She looks shaken.
"Ben."
Stan walks up behind her, puts his hands on her shoulders, and says,
"Ben, what are you involved in?"
"What am I involved in?" Ben asks. "What are you involved in?" 2:39. They pull into the parking lot, a warehouse complex in the canyon, old sea trains scattered around, empty, quiet. Crow's charger is already there. Chon lies on the floor of the van behind Brian. He pushes the shotgun barrel into the back of the seat.
"You feel that, Brian? It will go right through this seat into your spine. The best you can hope for is a helper monkey."
"I feel it."
"Pull up beside him and get out."
Chon feels the van slow and then stop. The door opens. Brian gets out. Crow rolls down his window and shoots Brian in the head. 2:40.
"I was aware," Patterson says, "that your mother married me for my money. I was in my 40s, she was in her 20s, and beautiful. I knew, everybody knew. I married her anyway."
O sits and listens. Patterson continues.
"I knew that I was her second husband, but wouldn't be her last. It was all right with me. I was happy just to borrow her beauty for a few years."
Borrow, O wonders, or rent?
"We didn't have a prenuptial agreement," Patterson says. "My family was furious, my lawyers more so, but Kim wouldn't hear of it. I knew what I was doing.
but money has never been my problem in life. One agreement that we did have, however, is that there would be no children. O winces. I was too old, Patterson says, and didn't want to cut that ridiculous figure of the middle-aged father trying to keep up with a toddler. But there was more to it. I knew the marriage would never last, and as a child of divorce myself, I didn't want to inflict that on another child. But you did, O thinks. I knew that she was unfaithful, Patterson says. She would be gone for long, unexplained hours. She would take little trips. I knew, but I didn't want to know, so I never pressed the issue. Until she informed me that she was pregnant. With me, O says. Patterson nods. 2:41. Ben follows them into the study, the walls lined with bookshelves filled with psychology texts, sociological studies, economic histories, evidence of their belief that the truth of the world is contained in books, if only you could read enough of them, and the right ones. Now Ben wants a truth that can't be found in books and says, please, I need to know. We came here in the fresh bloom of our idealism, Diane explains. We thought we would change the world. Ben's about to object to the whole diamonds and rust monologue he senses is coming, but then his mother starts talking about a guy giving away tacos. 2:42. Chan watches Crow get out of the car and stand over Brian's body, making sure. There's not a lot of doubt. Brian's lifeless eyes stare up at the moon, and a pool of blood forms beneath his head. Chan slides the van door open and drops to the ground. Belly crawls around until he sees Crow swinging his gun at the sound. Crow sees him and fires. But Chan has already dropped into a low crouch. Can't shoot the man, can't take a chance on killing him, so he drops the shotgun, lunges, and tackles Crow at the waist, driving him into the sand. 58,000 fucking times he practiced on the sand south of here, down on Silver Strand, but he's weak now, and rusty. So he lets Crow's gun hand come around as he tries to jam the gun barrel into Chan's head, and the shot is deafening, a roar like a big wave going off, and Chan feels the burn and his head roaring as he gets his knee up and drives Crow's arm to the sand and traps it there. But Crow is big and strong, and he pounds his left fist into Chan's ribs, then the side of his head, bangs his hips up and bridges his back, trying to buck Chan off. But Chan slides up and gets his other knee on Crow's left forearm, and now he kneels on the man's arms, feels the blood running hot down his face, his pulse slamming in his neck, and he takes his thumbs and presses them into Crow's eyes. Chan's forearms quiver with exertion. He's trying to hold it until Crow screams and drops the gun and yells, "Enough!" Chan grabs Crow's pistol and gets off him, holding the gun on him. Crow rolls onto his stomach, presses his palms into his eyes, and moans, "I can't see! I can't see!" Chan walks over to his shotgun and picks it up. He feels blood seeping out of his left leg, where the wounds have opened up from the fight. When he comes back, Crow is on his knees, trying to get up. Chan kicks him back down, presses the shotgun barrel into his neck. "Who do you work for?"
"They'll kill me."
"They're not your worry right now," Chan says. "I am. Who do you work for?" Crow shakes his head. Chan's out of wind, and his leg starts to throb. He says, "They wouldn't die for you." Crow gives him a name. It hits Chan like a blow to the chest. He leans over and says, "Tell me the truth. Did you kill those two kids?" Crow nods. Chan pulls the trigger. "Sorry, Ben." He drags Crow's body over by Hennessy's, then puts the shotgun in Hennessy's hands and lays the pistol by Crow's. Justice or revenge? Either way. Taking his knife, Chan cuts a strip off his shirt and presses it against the open wound on his leg. Then he notices that it's raining.
2:43.
What happened? Ben asks when Diane finishes her story.
2:44.
Chan starts to run, a steady, disciplined trot. It's only 6 or 7 miles, nothing to it. The rain grows heavier now. Thick, heavy drops fall on his shoulders, run down his side and his leg. The blood mixes with the water.
2:45.
John 14:2. In my Father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you.
2:46.
What happened? Stan repeats. To us? To the country? What happened when childhood ends in Dealey Plaza, in Memphis, in the kitchen of the ambassador? Your belief, your hope, your trust lying in a pool of blood again. 55,000 of your brothers dead in Vietnam, 1 million Vietnamese. Photos of naked napalm children running down a dirt road. Kent State, Soviet tanks roll into Prague, so you turn on, drop out. You know you can't reinvent the country. But maybe you reimagine yourself. You believe, you really believe that you can create a world of your own. And then you lower that expectation to just a piece of ground to make a stand on, but then you learn that piece of ground costs money that you don't have. What happened? Altamont, Charlie Manson, Sharon Tate, Son of Sam, Mark Chapman, we saw a dream turn into a nightmare. We saw love and peace turn into endless war and violence, our idealism into realism, our realism into cynicism, our cynicism into apathy, our apathy into selfishness, our selfishness into greed, and then greed was good.